The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. A scratchy 1-0 win over Austria means that surely now it's coming home. But maybe home to Scotland. Jack Grealish at the centre of things for England. Jude Oldhead on young shoulders, Bellingham. Jordan Pickford impressing with feet and hands. And how high can Dominic Calvert-Lewin jump? There are still some questions at the back. And poor Trent Alexander-Arnold. The nation sweats on the news of his thigh. More depressingly, fans boo taking the knee. What, if anything, is the solution? Scotland take on the Netherlands without seven players and only fail to win because of a dodgy free kick. They're going to be good, aren't they? I can't take it. Who's excited for a hands in a natural position chat? An early red card for Wales turns their friendly in France into even more of a mismatch. There's FIFA Times with Philippe Auclair. He'll record an hour, the lawyers will listen, and you'll get the safest 5 minutes. And we'll all rejoice about Wes Houlihan's new one-year deal at Cambridge United. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair, hello.
Hello to you, Max. Good morning.
Good morning. Barry Glendenning, good morning.
Hi, Max.
Roscoe says, oh no, if Ewan Murray is on, there must be some sort of crisis in the Scotland camp. Now, we've got Ewan on just purely out of love and nothing to do with crises, I don't think. Hey, Ewan.
Give it 7 days, we'll be in full crisis mode. But for now, we're okay.
You're on a high. You're yes. In a going to Portugal and drawing with the Netherlands high, Ewan.
Absolutely.
What a place to be. But hold your horses, we're starting with England. Maybe we shouldn't, but that's what we're going to do. Barca Jim Burke, another Scottish correspondent of the show. If it is coming home, what mode of transport is it using to come home? Matt says, will it have had its tea when it gets home? Barry, what did you make of this scintillating football match?
Well, it started badly with the crowd booing the knee, proving that some England fans are probably... football fans in general are thicker than a submarine door. I don't think we learned much from the game. It was the Austrians were quite aggressive, and I think the best thing England can take out of it is the fact that they only suffered one serious injury and that Bukayo Saka scored his first goal for his country. And there was good performance from him, from Jack Grealish, from Jude Bellingham, and... yeah, there's not a huge amount as I could read into it.
You started there talking about the fans booing the taking of the knee. Some fans did it. I would guess a sizable minority is probably an accurate way of describing that. It was drowned out eventually by applause. Southgate said, I did hear it. It's not something on behalf of our black players I wanted to hear because it feels as though it's a criticism of them. I think we've got a situation where some people seem to think it's a political stand that they don't agree with. That's not the reason players are doing it. I was pleased that was drowned out by the majority of the crowd. Saka said, I don't understand why they did it. I heard some boos and some claps. You'll have to ask the fans that were booing to understand why they did it. I think the thing is, Philippe, you know, as Baz says there, that's his first goal for England and he's being asked that question. Like, surely that is enough for the England fans who booed to go, perhaps we shouldn't be booing this, regardless if there are, you know, more serious conversations about just wanting equality in the world.
Yes. But by the way, I think his answer was the right one. I think instead of asking him, we should be asking the people who are booing, why exactly are you doing it? What is it that players taking the knee, making a stand against discrimination, why are you finding this offensive? Why are you booing it? And I think that was the right answer. And to be honest, I don't think there's a way out of this. what are you going to do? Are you going to put cameras and check out? I mean, who is doing it and prevent them from attending a game? That's not going to work, is it? And actually, you might think that that would be ridiculous. That would be an overreaction, and it would lead to more reaction. The fact is that there is within the England supporting group a nucleus which is not insignificant, which has shown this kind of behavior over the years, and that getting rid of them, despite the best efforts on the FA, and they're genuinely trying, and also some genuine supporters clubs, it's proving almost impossible to do so. So I'm afraid this is here to stay. It's an indictment of the state of things in our country, I suppose.
Well, I think if you ask the people who are booing, they'd mumble something about Black Lives Matter being a political group, and they're worried about Marxist left taking over the country and they don't want politics in football. But booing a gesture of tolerance is in itself a political act. Wearing a poppy is a political act. And, you know, they don't... It's a pre-match ritual. They don't like it, that's fine. But they don't boo the pre-match handshake. They don't boo the warm-up. They don't boo the coin toss. Why boo this? I don't get it. But I think if you're not anti-racist, then, in my opinion...
You're
you must be pro-racist.
Yes.
There's also, Barry, there's also, to me, there's two elements to this, or two that stand out. One, by the player's own, you know, testimony, this booing offends the black players in the England team. So this behaviour, you know, is offensive to players in the team that they claim they're there to support. So why would you do that? That makes no sense whatsoever. And secondly, as you touched on, Barry, and I've been there, if you go to a football game and there's some kind of mark of respect, or whatever it might be, for something you disagree with, just sit quietly. Sit down. You don't boo. You don't make a scene. Just stay out of it by sitting in your seat. That's all you have to do. You can make the point that way without offending, as I say, in this case, offending players in the team that you are supposedly going to the game to support. That makes no sense whatsoever on any level.
Trent Alexander-Arnold looked very upset and bewildered when it happened.
I bet he was.
I mean, we've got to remember that there was a part of the England support that, when England beat Brazil in the Maracanã, discounted John Barnes' goal because he had been scored by a black guy. So these people are still with us. You know, they haven't gone away completely.
I think you're right. I mean, I don't see enough of England now, but having encountered England, the England support, and I don't want to generalise, that's unfair, but there has been a problematic element, a not insignificant problematic element, and the England support for years and years and years. And I think Philippe's right. To suggest that's just going to go away overnight is probably fanciful.
Hmm. I mean, I also experienced that in 2006 when I didn't work in this, you know, in football at all, and went as an England fan and experienced it. Feels different when it's the travelling England fans to just, you know, fans who've gone to a home game. But I wonder if it's sort of a banal practicality of what happens, but the players take the knee, people boo, then people applaud. I wonder if it would send the right message if fans who accepted and believed in taking the knee and saw it as a good thing started applauding straight away, or even started cheering straight away, so that even if there are boos, they are drowned out. Because it did feel to me like more people were applauding to basically say, I'm not supporting what you're doing. So I think it might be a sort of a proactive way to at least change the optics of that. That doesn't change, you know, systemic racism or the fact that some people might boo it, but it won't give them their 10 seconds of people hearing the boos. On the pitch, as you mentioned, Barry, I mean, Grealish and Bellingham, to me, Philippe, looked like the best performers for England yesterday.
Yes, which won't come necessarily as a surprise. I mean, even though I'm quite reluctant to say anything more than that about that particular game, it's also quite a feeble adversary on the night. A team that contains, what, three of the possible starters against Croatia? I would say 2.5, because Jordan Pickford, yet again, made me wonder why he was in goal and not in Henderson. But there you go.
Oh, really? I thought he played quite well, Pickford.
Oh, really? Okay. All right. He doesn't inspire confidence, instill confidence in me, but that's maybe just me, you know. Okay, well, let's say there are three starters. So how can you say, apart from the fact it was nice for Ben White to have his first cap, it was good for Bukayo Saka to show for England what he's been showing almost every game with Arsenal. And he could be a really useful player as well as the tournament goes on, because he can fill in any position. And by the way, he can play at right back as well, if we're really sorry not to have four right backs any longer. Fingers crossed for Trent Alexander-Arnold, of course. But it looked a little bit plodding and pedestrian to me. Am I being too harsh, perhaps? I mean, what do you expect as well?
No,
coming into a tournament, you can imagine that the players will not go 100% in a game like that, apart perhaps from those who have absolutely nothing to lose, who know they are not going to be part of the first 11, or indeed are not going to be part of the 26 for the tournament. Otherwise, you're going to be careful about, you know, how much weight you put in your challenges, how hard you sprint towards the ball. You don't want to do a hamstring. You don't want to do all these things. So, it's just basically a nice training exercise in which, as you say, Jack Grealish, Bukayo Saka and Jude Bellingham showed their qualities, and which is great.
Dave says, with Jack Grealish nursing a shin injury, are his teeny tiny shin pads looking madder than ever? Sure, the Death Star had a thermal exhaust port that made it blow up, but Darth Vader didn't stand next to it, pointing and yelling, "Fire torpedoes here." There was a really brilliant tweet, which was actually sent to Football Clichés from someone called Davsky Cross, going, "Have Opta got anything on biggest difference in sock height on substitution? Because when Grealish went off with his tiny socks, Ben White came on with his socks sort of rolled up, so there was no skin between his shorts and his very, very high socks." It was good to see.
They deserve to be called stockings, as they should be on this occasion, yes.
You're absolutely right. On sort of disappointing news, the Trent Alexander-Arnold injury is obviously, we are sweating, the nation sweats Barry on his fitness. It didn't look good. I did enjoy Sam Matterface going to Lee Dixon and saying, "Can you just lip read what Trent says?" And Lee Dixon sort of going, "Well, I'm not a trained lip reader here. it's not something I knew I needed to bring to the role." But it didn't look good. Obviously, lots of people have tweeted, you know, "Ollie, now that Trent's out, do England call up Wan-Bissaka or just take three right-backs to a major tournament? Risky. Peter, does the Trent potential injury open the door for Dean Austin and David Kerslake? Or is John Scales a better option as he could play century two?" But it's a real shame for him, isn't it?
Of course it is, yeah. And by if the look on his face is anything to go by, as he went off, I think the jig is up and he won't participate. But, you know, hopefully he might make a miraculous recovery. Whether or not it's a huge blow to England's prospects, I don't think it is. A lot of people didn't expect him to be selected anyway. But after all the palaver, it's an awful shame that he gets injured in the first friendly before the tournament. And, yeah, your heart would go out to him, but that is football, Max.
Ewan, you saw Tyrone Ming's slightly interesting challenge early in the first half. It's been tweeted out and repeated a lot of times. It's an odd thing to do. And, you know, people say of Tyrone Ming's, you know, quote, "He's got a mistake in him." I guess we all in life have a mistake in us, don't we? The key is to not bring out the mistake at the worst possible time. So perhaps good for him to get it out of the way during a friendly.
Well, I mean, it was just rash and, dare I say, violent. I mean, as you said, it was a strange thing to do. I mean, and also, you know, we've kind of had a chuckle about this, but there was no need to run towards the opposition player and do that. And then, as I say, when you take it down the line of what damage can be caused and what damage we've seen at the weekend can be caused, I don't think it's too much of a leap of faith to say there could be or should be retrospective disciplinary action towards him for that. It was a wild, needless challenge.
Baz?
Well, I said yesterday that I think Mings, he does have a mistake in him. I think he's a bit of a liability, and I've noticed he's not universally popular among Aston Villa fans either. I mean, I think he's a terrific bloke and a good player, but if England make it to the knockout stages, these games are decided on very fine margins, and I wouldn't trust him. But Gareth Southgate obviously does, and his is the only opinion that matters.
But another thing that I would like to add to that, if you don't mind, Max, is the fact that I think the big news for me in some ways is that Jordan Henderson didn't take part in this game. And that as days go by, the more we're going to question the fact that you go into a tournament with two major players who are not fit. For the life of me, I don't understand that.
Yeah, but we've won tournaments before when we've taken in some players.
I believe that Jordan Henderson was supposed to play yesterday, but Southgate said he woke up yesterday morning and had some sort of a niggle. So they scanned him. It was clear, but they didn't risk him. But it is a worry that he hasn't played any football, competitive football, since
February.
Middle of February.
Lars Sivertsen says, "I feel like we should talk more about Dominic Calvert-Lewin almost jumping clean over an actual man. WTF. Zach says, "How can Southgate make the most of Calvert-Lewin's ability to jump miles in the air? Should Calvert-Lewin consider a career in superheroics?" apparently, it was an extraordinary height he got on that joke. He was booked for the challenge, and I wasn't sure. The defender, I reckon, sort of moved across, and it might have been dangerous from him, but perhaps I'm just biased. But apparently, and I'm hoping Philippe can help me on this, or anyone else, Duncan McKenzie of Leeds United used to jump over minis. There's a photo of Duncan McKenzie jumping over minis, a mini as part of like the pre-match entertainment. I can't see the gaffer being...
I want
saying,
to see that.
It's a good. I think it was before a testimonial or a friendly. But even still,
I know a fellow who works as a fitness instructor, and his party piece is that he can jump on a bar counter in a pub, so he can jump on the bar from a standing start, which is just remarkable.
That's like half a Calvert-Lewin, isn't it? Really, I mean, because he can jump over a mat. I suppose Calvert-Lewin had a run-up. To be fair, we need to get the two of them in a room. Perhaps before a game, for the pre-match entertainment. You're not going to play today, Dominic, probably, but we've bought a bar or a mini or a man and see what you can jump over.
Maybe it's time to bring back the Olympic discipline of the standing jump. They used 100%. To clear something like 6 foot.
Calvert-Lewin will win gold and then get Sports
gold
Personality
for
of the Year.
Yeah.
Mojo Duffelcoat said, did Ben Godfrey try for the ultimate FU Southgate with that back pass shot with his first touch, having been released from the squad, put on the pitch, almost scored an own goal. The great picture of that was when the ball was going towards the net and you could see him put his hands on his head going, this is not how I want my England debut to begin. This is a fever dream. This is my Wes Morgan.
Mike, I find that... Sorry, I know there was a bit of chat with Barry on social media about this yesterday, but I still find this odd that England, in a pre-tournament friendly... You know, the basis of which is surely to prepare for this tournament. We're playing guys who are not going to be in their squad for the actual tournament. Now, I know there was reasoning behind that. Some players hadn't joined up. I get it. But it strikes me as a very strange preparation plan that these games, and they've only got, two games, don't involve people who aren't going to be in the squad. That seems weird to me.
I don't know what else they were meant to do, though. That's the thing. I mean, because there's no Chelsea, Manchester United, Manchester City players, they've got to have some people, because otherwise the players they pick will be knackered and get injured. They can't just sort of WhatsApp their mates and say, look, are you free this morning?
Well, there's two sides to that. I would argue, one, they arrange the games for when these players would be available. And also, I mean, I know that, you know, Billy Gilmour played 9 minutes last night and didn't play for Chelsea, but Billy Gilmour and Scott McTominay, having been involved in the squads for these finals, well, they were in Portugal as part of the Scotland squad that could play against Holland last night. So, you know, even that's a bit odd. Why wouldn't you just get the players there? It's a major tournament. It's important preparation. I find it strange that people haven't focused on the kind of weirdness of this build-up by England. It seems a bit lax to me. I hope it's lax anyway.
The mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, tweeted your question, and I replied saying they can't name any players. And he said, oh, fair enough. So I thought my answer would work on you too, but you had a better comeback. anyway, that'll do for part one. We'll talk about Scotland's draw with Netherlands in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now on June the 10th, Thursday night, 7:30 p.m, me, Wilson, Lars, Barry doing a live show. You can get tickets for £7 at theguardian.com/guardianlive. It goes onto your laptop. If you can't watch it live, you can watch it on catch up. We've even got production on this episode with things like jingles and stings and a halftime show, which I need to tell Barry about. And come along, please. All people on earth are welcome. TheGuardian.com/GuardianLive. So, Netherlands 2, Scotland 2. Mark says, how scared are you now, Max, personally, about the Scotland game after our reserves played so well against the world-class Dutch? Dan says, will you teach Ewan Murray your hot pant dance? And will he do it when Scotland win the Euros? Chris, if the Netherlands are dark horses, then are Scotland dark horses too? That was really impressive, wasn't it, Ewan? Especially without seven players. John Fleck had COVID. Six other players had to isolate. Despite the fact that Scotland said no one has been near John Fleck. I don't know how they quite trained with John Fleck, because he just trains on his own anyway. But seven players out and a really, really good performance.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at the players who missed it specifically, Scott McTominay wasn't involved in that COVID situation, but they left him on the bench having... You know, he joined up late, having been involved in the Europa League final. John McGinn didn't play. Che Adams didn't play. The goalkeeping situation, I think, is a toss-up anyway, maybe, but David Marshall has normally been Steve Clark's first choice, didn't play. Grant Hanley is a favourite of his, would have played at centre-back. So, you know, I think John Fleck, in isolation, pardon the pun, wasn't that much of a deal, but the other players who missed that game, you know, would be first-choice starters. So it was a very impressive performance. Scotland were comfortable defensively, I thought, and were really kind of coherent and fluid. They had six or seven chances against the Dutch, which was impressive. And you know, I thought they played very, very well. There was a lot to be encouraged about for now.
I thought the first goal was interesting. It was a great finish from Jack Henry, wasn't it? But there was a kind of high press. And in my mind, Scotland would be a park 10 behind the ball. I only saw the highlights, but were they doing that consistently?
Yes. And interestingly, after the game, Steve Clark said that worked well on occasion and sometimes it didn't. We have to try harder with regards to that. I mean, before the game, Steve Clark said that the Dutch were the opponents he wanted with a view to playing specifically England, actually, and to a lesser extent, Croatia. Now, you know, I haven't drilled too much into the tactical detail of that, but I took it he wanted that high scale of opposition to see how Scotland could fare with a view to the tournament. And with that in mind, you know, he has to be very pleased because they performed very well. Now, the Dutch, you know, there is a slight favour. They took Wijnaldum off after half an hour. They took Frankie de Jong off after half an hour. But still, you know, and I think very much the Netherlands look to me like a real work in progress still. I wouldn't be rushing out putting money on them to win the Euros. But from a Scotland context, I thought it was a really encouraging performance.
And that cross from Robertson for Nisbet is just, it's perfect. It's a sort of underrated skill. You don't, you know, that is eye of the needle stuff from him.
Great move. And probably a more difficult finish than Nisbet made it look. You know, he's new to the international scene. He was just on the pitch, but he kind of ghosted away from the Dutch defence and finished it really well. And listen, after that, they were under a lot of pressure late in the game, and a draw, you can argue, was a fair result, although it was a very, very soft free kick for the equalising goal for Memphis Depay. But I think there was, even at, you know, I took the attitude even at 2-1 up, that even if they lost a goal, or dare I say, even lost two late goals, there was enough there to be pretty pleased and pretty positive about.
And like the key for Scotland, correct me if I'm wrong, they've never got out the group stages of a major tournament before. This opening game, with you can get through if you come third. The game against the Czech Republic, that first game, is just enormous for them, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, if they get 3 points there, they're in a fantastic position. I mean, I think of what Northern Ireland did in the last Euros. As you said, I think four out of the six groups, the third place team will get through. If they can get 3 points at hand and against the Czechs, they're suddenly in a very, very strong position. And it's funny how the mood changes. I mean, after Scotland qualified for the Euros, they lost to Slovakia 1-0. I think they lost to Israel, then drew with Israel, drew at home to Austria. And there was a kind of feeling they were sleepwalking towards this tournament a little bit. And it's funny how last night's game has completely changed the mood. Added, I think, to the, although he's barely played, the Billy Gilmore factor, I think, has made people more positive and more confident. His emergence, his involvement in the squad. I think how well Scott McTominay played in the Europa League final, again, has kind of lifted the mood. And pretty sharply, actually, I've sensed within Scotland, attitudes have changed. And after a few months where we were a little bit, you know, this tournament could be a step too far, suddenly there's an upbeat feeling again. So long may that continue. Well, may it continue until whether it is 4 o'clock and the Monday the 14th when the Czech Republic game finishes.
I was about to say, this is the sort of cheeriest and sort of most happy-go-lucky I've ever heard you, Ewan.
It's because I haven't played a competitive game yet. Just to build up.
Another Ewan says, can Ewan Murray explain why Craig Gordon is in the Scotland squad with a straight face? What is the situation there?
Craig Gordon?
Yeah, you sound surprised. I'm just the messenger here. What is the goalkeeping situation?
Well, Craig Gordon's in the squad because he's one of the three best available goalkeepers. In fact, I would argue probably the best available goalkeeper. David Marshall, as I said, was Steve Clark's first choice, memorably saved the penalty in Serbia that took Scotland through. But David Marshall had he didn't play Derby's last few games in the Championship, and I think had a difficult season at domestic level. Craig Gordon is obviously an older goalkeeper, not that David Marshall is young, so maybe that's what the listener's scepticism has moved towards. But he's still, I mean, he had one superb save last night from Patrick Van Aanholt. There is a train of thought that he should have done better with the equalising free kick, but I'm always wary of criticising goalkeepers' positioning and wall positioning because that's quite a specialised area. But No, he's in the squad because he's one of the, I mean, Alan McGregor retired from Scotland duty, so doesn't play. So your goalkeepers are certainly Craig Gordon, David Marshall, John McLaughlin, and I'm not sure there's much dispute that they're the best three available. And within that, Craig, you know, on a level playing field, is the best goalkeeper. But his age now suggests maybe, and what Marshall has done before suggests maybe Marshall will come back into the team. But I think there's a point for debate around that.
Whenever, Barry, I hear people discussing who should be the Scotland goalkeeper, it does remind me of the greatest phone call to talk sport of all time, or actually to any sports radio station. Do you know the one I'm thinking of?
Yes.
Where you do. The Scotland fan rings up. I think it's Arthur Alviston is doing the phone in. And he's like, I don't understand why, I can't remember who the manager is, can't find a place in the squad for Antti Niemi. And Arthur Alviston says, he's finished. And the bloke goes, he's not finished. He's only 28. No, he's from Finland. Ah, he's not Scottish. No. All right. Thanks for your call. Goodbye. Anyway, let's move on to France beating Wales, and we'll introduce Ben Fisher, who reported on the game for The Guardian. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Max.
Sam Blair says, in a friendly, should France have the option of declining that red card, a la penalties in American football? I don't know the American football rule. Why would either team want to play 11v10 in a tune-up friendly? Philippe, what do you reckon?
I agree with that, and you know who agrees with that is Hugo Lloris. When he was asked after the game, and Hugo said, you know, we pleaded with the referee not to send Nico Williams off because it made absolutely no sense in this context. But unfortunately, nothing you can do about that.
You would imagine the referee probably didn't want to send him off either. And I don't think he should have sent him off. I don't think it was a red card offence. But the referee has to be seen to do the right thing because he wants to, you know, progress in the game as well and, you know, work in the tournament and whatever. So it was a bit of a farce.
These red cards don't have any lingering suspension issues, do they, in international friendlies? Or do they?
They do, yeah. Nico, unless it's overturned, will be suspended for their game on Saturday or Sunday, whenever it is. So, but it's only one match, so he only misses a friendly. But he needs minutes because he hasn't played very much this season, so it's not ideal.
Ben, did you think that was a red card? I mean, I saw Mark Pugac and Lee Dixon doing the ITV highlight show saying, look, that's a pen and that's a red card. And Ian Wright, even though it's, you know, it's annoying, but it is by the letter of the law. My initial reaction was, that's a ridiculous decision. And then I thought, maybe there's a way of changing the law so it could be a penalty but not a red card. I don't know.
No, I thought it was extremely harsh. It was one of those, the more times you look at it, inevitably you can slow it down. And as we know, that things look worse when you slow them down. The referee took ages, a good couple of minutes looking at Daniel James and saying after, you know, if it takes that long, surely there's no need for it. And also there was that kind of sense of, come on, ref, it's a friendly. Like, just let it go. I suppose even if it was the most blatant handball ever, you were sort of saying, you know, it's a friendly. And ultimately for both teams, it was just a bit of a disaster because, don't get me wrong, for France it was probably better. They had a chance to, you know, sort of knock it around. But ultimately, they're not going to get that freedom against Germany, or it's unlikely, isn't it, unless they go down to 10 men. And for Wales, it was, yeah, pretty painful exercise for more than an hour.
Apparently, the fourth official apologised to Rob Page during the second half, which I quite like the idea of him just going, oh, yeah, sorry about that. I mean, what can you do? There's nothing you can do. But I think that they need to come up with a way of fixing that in friendlies. And and also this idea about the hand being in an unnatural position is only judged by people who only ever look at still images and have never, not just like people who've played the game say, oh, the hands are in a natural position. But when you move around, if you move around at pace, your hands are connected to your body. They move in strange way. You know, that is not unnatural, actually, when you're moving quickly. Like if you try moving quickly without moving your arms, it's ridiculous. I'm doing a lot of, this is not useful for the podcast, but I'm doing a lot of physical theatre right now.
After the game, Rob Page, it's probably the most irked I've seen him in sort of the last few months. Obviously, he's had a lot to contend with, but he's sort of kept his cool and been really impressive, actually. But last night, he could tell he was really frustrated by everything. And he said after that, the referee, the Portuguese referee, just said to him, oh, sorry, coach, And I don't think that really cut the mustard with Rob Page.
I guess it's very hard to analyse Wales at all then from this football match. I mean, it's nice of you to come on, Ben, but like, what can you tell us?
I think there are actually a few more positives than maybe the sort of Wales camp were sort of making out. Danny Ward probably, I think, cemented his number one shirt. That Rob Page had said it was a choice between him and Wayne Hennessy, who I think will get minutes against Albania on Saturday. Danny Ward made three, maybe four brilliant saves, obviously the penalty from Benzema. And in midfield, Joe Allen's return, a real big boost, seemed to come through unscathed. And Joe Morrell of Luton, has, I think he's only played maybe four or five starts all season, you know, up against Pogba, and that in there didn't look out of place at all.
Philippe, France have quite a good team. You may not have noticed this. And if you stick N'Golo Kanté in there, who's obviously the greatest footballer to ever have existed this week.
We agree.
I mean, they've got quite the force, haven't they?
Well, they have. It's a strange one because, I mean, some managers would treat these friendlies as basically preparation, rotate the squad, have a look at a couple of players. Well, that's not Deschamps' style at all, as you saw. It is basically, if you substitute Kanté for Tolisso, it is the first 11 that you're going to see through the tournament. And because there is a very simple reason for that, is that he must know, or he must try to find ways to have this attacking trident working together. And which is one of the reasons why it was a bit very frustrating to see Nico Williams being sent off after 25 minutes, because against the team that's playing, you know, with 10 men, obviously you're going to learn less. But he will have been satisfied with what he saw. Benzema looked very, very sharp. So did Griezmann and Mbappe. There were no signs that they were walking on each other's toes, or they were really quite good at permutating as well their positions, sometimes on the left, sometimes on the right, Benzema dropping back and so on. So he will be satisfied, very satisfied even with the performance after the 25th minute. But to be honest, I mean, I think Ben will agree with me that the first 25 minutes until 23 minutes, until that handball, Wales had really held their own. And actually, Lloris had had quite a tricky situation to deal with Danny James, who was very lively, actually, throughout the game. So he will look at both parts of the game, Deschamps, and, the first bit he will think, the tempo was not quite right, the pace was not right. But the rest of the game he will be satisfied with, yes, absolutely. Even if France again missed a penalty. It's quite extraordinary. The stat is, I don't know, do you know the stat, Max?
No.
Well,
no.
Of the last eight penalties that France has taken, we've managed to miss five. Five out of eight. Three by Antoine Griezmann against Sweden, Andorra and Albania. Kylian Mbappe missed one against Kazakhstan, and then Karim Benzema, I should say missed it. To be honest, the save is really very, very, very good. It's a penalty that 99% of the time would go in, but that's 5 out of 10, so let's hope it doesn't come to a penalty shootout during the competition, because that might be a bit hairy.
Unless David De Gea is in the opposition goal.
That is very true.
My Wi-Fi was just a bit slower than yours, Barry, for exactly the same joke. But I grant it to you there. Ben, would you like to agree with Philippe? He gave you a great chance to agree with him there.
Yeah, I do agree. And I think Philippe was alluding, there was a sort of a counter-attack where James went forward and Kimpembe did well to sort of just nick it away from Joe Allen, of all people, before Wales could have taken the lead in theory. Yeah, obviously the red card changed. But like I said, I think there were lots of positives in. Just the other thing I was going to note was I think it was almost like a World Cup final of national anthems, two belters. Just a shame no fans there to ramp it up.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. Just quickly, Philippe, what does this all mean for poor Olivier Giroud?
It means that he's going to have the role that everybody knows he's going to have, as he's going to be Plan B and Plan C and Plan Z. And we'll see him. Absolutely no doubt about that. You'll see him. The one thing I would say is that if people haven't had a chance to see France's second goal, they should look at it, because it is it's a thing of beauty. And it's a thing of beauty in which actually Benzema and Mbappe and Griezmann combine, and Benzema at the start, nothing too spectacular, but doing the good thing, you know, the right thing. Kylian Mbappe, just lovely deft touch, back heel to Griezmann, takes half a yard and then places this curler in the top corner. It's a thing of absolute beauty, and which shows, you know, I think people can fear this French team a little bit. Do you think people realise that they might have to be afraid of this French team, Max?
Well, obviously England are going to win, but if they don't, then yes, I think France are quite good. Ben, you're off to Baku, aren't you? I mean, are you going to do a travel diary? I'd watch any content you deliver from Baku.
I'll see what the appetite is. Maybe on the back of this podcast, if anybody's got any, you know, tips, I'm all ears.
Ben in Baku. Well, look, have a safe trip.
It's got a ring to it, hasn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, have a safe trip. And we'll chat to you when you're out there.
I was just going to ask Ben, if I may, what difference has it made to Wales having or not having their manager in position? I mean, it's a weird situation, but has it made any noticeable difference to the way Wales go about things or play or behave? I mean, is it going to be a factor, do you think?
I don't... Yeah, it's a good question, Ewan. I'm not sure. I think, obviously, no Ryan Giggs. Rob Page very close with Ryan Giggs. He has said that if he needed to, he wouldn't hesitate to sort of contact him for advice and sort of if Ryan is willing to kind of lend an ear during the tournament. But, and I think that from people I've spoken to as well, I think there is a tinge of he would much rather be doing this with Ryan Giggs, you know, as his assistant. Clearly that's not happening. FAW have been at pains to say, you know, this is business as usual. And in terms of the team we've seen, I'm expecting kind of Ryan Giggs's team, if you like, and sort of Rob Page to carry that on. The big question will be what he does up front. He went with a false nine again last night against France. Personally, I think I would go with Kiefer Moore up there. I think he just causes a few more issues, but be interesting what they do.
Yeah, worth pointing out for those who don't know, Ryan Giggs is facing domestic violence charges, which he denies, but he's due in court, so we obviously can't talk about the case. We will as and when there's a verdict to it. Ben, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks a lot. Cheers, guys.
Ben Fisher there, on his way to Baku. And we will hear from Ben throughout the Euros from Azerbaijan. Philippe, you watched Germany 1, Denmark 1. Was it worth it?
Yeah, I think so, because I think like many people, I just looked at the scoreline and I thought, ooh, this is strange. I was, you know, you would be expecting, you would expect Germany to win this, and if not handsomely, but when I looked at the game, I think my opinion changed a little bit, because Germany basically bossed the first half, creating six very, very clear-cut chances, and finally opened the scoring after half-time. Quite a, the goal was not one of the most beautiful you'll ever see by Neuhaus. And then Denmark equalised through Yusuf Poulsen, who was put through by an absolutely gorgeous pass by Christian Eriksen. Who else, of course? One of those De Bruyne passes, which bisects the field and absolutely perfectly, perfectly putting Poulsen in position. So they also, the Germans also hit the woodwork twice. So basically, if you look at it and you think, maybe they're finding it a bit difficult, or it was they were the day off. No, it was just one of those days. Müller and Hummels, by the way, were in the starting lineup, for those who wondered.
All right. Interesting. Thanks, Philippe. That'll do for part two. Part three, FIFA Times. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. FIFA Corner, Philippe. A couple of weeks ago, Paul McInnes wrote a piece about FIFA exploring the possibility of staging the Men and Women's World Cups every 2 years. This was following a proposal for a feasibility study by the Saudi Arabian Football Federation, who said it was time to review how the global game is structured. That's what we all want. Infantino called it an eloquent and detailed proposal, with 166 national federations voting in favour, 22 voting against at FIFA's annual conference. So presumably getting a different coloured pen once they voted against.
Yes.
Philippe, what's this about?
It's about, I mean, what the Saudi FA has done here is very much like, you can imagine at the Soviet Communist Party, the annual plenary session with all the delegates in 1949, and somebody raising his hand and saying, I propose Comrade Stalin to be the leader of our country. And Stalin would say, well, thank you so much. I'm so glad you trust me. So that's what you do at FIFA. You have proxies. So you want something to happen. So since you cannot possibly put this on the agenda without the support of an FA or one of the member associations, you kindly ask this FA to, or this friendly FA, to put the proposal forward, and that's the way it goes. It's a part of protocol, which, to be honest, nobody is. Everybody is aware of what is going on, but it basically it's the idea that FIFA has. You can also remember that Arsene Wenger himself proposed that perhaps we should look at the periodicity of major competitions, and perhaps bring a 2-year cycle for the World Cup as well for both men and women, which actually are two different things, because there is an argument in some corners that, in fact, it's quite different when you talk about the men's game and the women's game, because the women's game is largely driven by global tournaments, and which involve national teams, and far more popular than club competitions, certainly, still at the moment. And that, in some ways, women's football would benefit from that, both in terms of exposure, but also in financial terms, because it is a competition you can sell. We need investment in women's football. Okay, so something which perhaps open to that. When it comes to the actual men's World Cup, it's yet another attempt to diminish the power of the confederations. Because obviously, if you have a World Cup every 2 years, you're not going to have a European Championships. It's going to be a bit of a problem. Suddenly, the World Cup becomes the big, big thing. And also, you need qualifiers and all the rest of it. So basically, it's part of this idea or this project, ambition rather than plan, that FIFA has to reorganize entirely the whole calendar, which both at club level and national team level, which has got, I think, the end result or the ambition is to make sure that FIFA controls absolutely everything when it comes to clubs and national teams, and that everything is brought under the umbrella. All the major competitions are brought under the umbrella of FIFA. That's the meaning of, all these efforts to get the Club World Cup. The reason why FIFA certainly didn't object to the Super League project, as we know that they were involved in the discussions from quite a long time ago, and we know that they hadn't told the Super League clubs that no, it was out of the question, despite what they maintained in public. It's part of a grand plan, which is basically we want the power. And when I say plan, Max, I'm in fact, maybe it's not the right word, because I don't think that there is somewhere in Gianni Infantino's, this room where he is in Zurich, where nobody can go, where there are white cats around and things like that. I don't think he's got like a wall chart. It's like, in 2026, this is what world football will look like. I think at the moment it's more throwing things about. See what can be accepted and what can't. And so you get the Saudis to do that and to propose this. And then you have a feasibility study, which people are quite happy to go along with because they don't want to go against the obvious wish of FIFA. And then once the feasibility study has been done, you have ground on which to put the, because obviously we'll find out that it's feasible, and you can put that to the FIFA Council, and the FIFA Council say, after all, maybe it's not a bad idea. And then UEFA, you can go forth and multiply. I mean, the last line is basically how you would sum up the whole situation. Confederations, go forth and multiply.
Now, FIFA would deny that they have a grand plan,
obviously,
to take over. A study doesn't guarantee the changes would be implemented, of course. No date has been set for the completion of the study. And Infantino says, we have to go into these studies with an open mind, but we are not going to take decisions which will jeopardize what we are already doing.
But that's exactly what they're already doing, so it's not going to jeopardize it. And if you want to have an illustration of that, maybe I could just mention a little thing which happened just a few days ago.
Yes.
In African football.
Yeah.
Where the new administration, which is led by Véron Monsengue-Omba, who is the former chief of member associations at FIFA, of course, and who's been parachuted as secretary general, kind of prime minister, basically, of CAF. They actually sacked 17 senior people from their positions in finance, in IT, human resources, you name it. So basically, they've sacked absolutely everybody in sight. And there's another few people who are going to be on their way so that they can put in their place. That's my interpretation of it, of course, and I'm sure FIFA would deny it, and I'm sure CAF would deny it, that they can put friendly faces, let's say, in charge of the departments at the African Confederation.
Is it not that surprising for a new president to clean up the house?
Absolutely. You change your secretary general. It's completely normal. But we're talking about people who are administrators. We're not talking about people who are necessarily political bodies or political agents. They're not. They're just people who do their job. Now, not everybody might be up to that job. Okay, it's possible. And of course, there are changes. But the changes, when they all happen at the same time, people get up in the morning, open their inbox, see a message from Veron Mossing or Ombai in their inbox saying, you've been sacked. And they all received it at the same time, without an interview, without an explanation given, and without an apology. That was that. 17 people. That's a lot, Max.
I mean, I suspect it's going to happen to me any day. Every day I open my email, I suspect that's going to happen to me.
Very true.
Ewan, Ange Postecoglou to Celtic. I've been singing his praises. He's an excellent manager with a great track record, but I know it. The idea of it hasn't excited the Parkhead masses particularly. What's the vibe you're getting?
Well, funnily enough, it didn't initially, because they were still reeling from Eddie Howe backing out at the 11th hour. And I thought this would happen. The more it kind of rumbles on, all these positive articles appear and positive noises about how he's actually a fantastic coach and this would be a great achievement to get him to Scotland. So I'm already sensing a bit of a sea change in previously negative attitudes towards him, to the point that as and when he's appointed, if we write negative articles about him, we'll be bombarded with abuse inevitably.
Perhaps there'll be so many positive articles, a bit like Eddie Howe, then he'll just go, there's something wrong here, and he won't take the job. I mean, what Celtic need to get a manager soon, don't they?
Yeah, I think we're already 100 days or more since Neil Lennon left. I mean, you know, I labour the point, but Celtic for years had such domestic dominance and such leeway. If there's any club in world football should have great kind of planning, succession planning, it's Celtic, because there's so much leeway to do this. So they should not be in a position where a manager leaves and it takes months and months and months to rebuild their football structure, especially now because, they've got major personnel issues. A lot of players want to leave. They need new players. Champions League qualifiers come around quickly and Rangers are in a positive position. So this is a big, big appointment, and I find it baffling that it's taken so long and wasn't sewn up earlier. And now, frankly, looks a little bit of a mess.
But you and... had they put the farm on getting Eddie Howe then? Because I'd heard that he was absolutely nailed on to take the job, but he wanted to bring coaching staff from Bournemouth and he wasn't able to approach them until the end of the season. Now, that may not be true, but I heard it from a fairly reliable source. So presumably he couldn't get those staff or something?
To answer the first part of your question, yes. I mean, I think this week, actually, Celtic plan to announce or unveil Eddie Howe. They believed it was a done deal. In fact, a number of weeks ago, they believed it was a done deal. But of course, it never is until everything's signed, sealed and delivered. There were numerous background issues with Eddie Howe, to the point where you could wonder if he was ever 100% into this or whether he had eyes on other things all along. I don't know Eddie Howe at all, and it would be unfair to speculate on his motives or agendas. But it's left Celtic in a really, really difficult position. I mean, on Postecoglou, you know, he looks an impressive guy in many ways. He's involved, you know, Yokohama are part owned by the Citigroup, so the fact he's part of that structure suggests he's not a dud coach. But I would just question how he gets to, you know, 55 years old and he hasn't worked in Europe. Not that Europe's the be all and end all, I know he's a Greek born Australian, but he hasn't worked in Europe at a major club yet. So for Celtic, it looks a massive, massive gamble to me at a time where, as I say, they have to get things right for all manner of, you know, financial and football reasons.
Ewan, has it all this current mess got to do with Peter Lowell leaving the club, who's been chief executive for so long, and leaving the club at the end of the season? Has it got to do with it? Is there a kind of a vacuum in terms of power within the club, which explains why it's taking so long to take decisions as important as this one?
Well, it shouldn't. I mean, Peter has been so strong and so powerful at that club for many, many years. You're right, he's leaving, but they appointed a new chief executive from Scottish Rugby who is already kind of in situ shadowing Peter. I would argue with Peter still there over the last few months, it should have been easier to put this new structure in place because he has the football expertise. He has the Celtic expertise. You know, the fact he was still there and hadn't yet left means they should have had this plan in place. I mean, to me, it's easy to be wise after the event, but to me, they should have hired a director of football immediately after Neil Lennon left. The director of football would then have a coach lined up to come at the end of the season
a recruitment plan for the end of the season, and then by certainly now, as we sit at the start of June, Celtic would be moving quickly. But they didn't make that other appointment. As we said, they believed Eddie Howe would come. That falls through. And then, as I say, they at least give the impression of being back to the drawing board. Celtic won't say that. They'll say Postecoglou and others were always on their radar, always in their mind, and that's fair enough. But a long, long time has passed since Neil Lennon has left, and a lot of things have happened for Celtic, not positive at all in an on-field sense, even to the point of going to the Ibrox for the last Old Firm game of the season and being trounced. So there's a lot of ground to make up, including with their own supporters, who, you know, they need to retrieve some goodwill. And I just find it strange. I mean, Peter Lawwell has been there long enough to absolutely know what he is doing. And I thought by now Celtic would have that structure in place and be firing, be signing players, be, you know, building positively towards next season. And that just hasn't happened. And they're stuck for the moment.
Danny says, what were you doing 20 years ago, Max? He also included a picture of Wes Houlihan after signing his first professional contract, where Wes looks like a wee young lad, just ready to embark on a glorious football career that would finally take him to the promised land. And Wes has done the right thing and signed a one-year contract extension at Cambridge United so that he can go and run rings around Ipswich Town again in a yellow shirt, but this time in the right yellow shirt. Thank you, Wes. I love you from the bottom of my heart. Mark says, who is using their microwave during the podcast? This was Flo Lloyd Hughes' boyfriend, who was microwaving something on the last pod, Barry, for about 15 minutes.
I did see him pottering around in the background. I found it a little bit distracting, but I didn't realise he was microwaving something. That passed me by, I must say.
No, I mean, had I noticed, I would have definitely brought it up and probably made the whole pod about it. So in many ways, probably lucky that we didn't notice. Anyway.
It is good that we have a new microwave anecdote in our locker.
Ever tell you about the mate? A mate of mine came in from a pretty epic night out and microwaved his wallet. True story.
His wallet?
Why?
Yeah. Well, he was well oiled and fancied something to eat, and in his drunken stupor put his wallet in the microwave for 3 minutes with pretty disastrous results, as you can imagine.
So what, did all his cards
True story.
And driving license melt or?
Yes. That's exactly what happened. Yes.
Burning cash.
True
That's
story.
The way to do it, isn't it? anyway, that'll do for today. Thanks, Billy.
Thank you. Could I just add one little thing?
You can.
Yeah, because it's going to be news today. So we're breaking news, right? Is that Liga is going down to 18 teams from 2023-24. Okay. The decision was taken yesterday and is going to be put to the committee today and is going to go through. So from 2023-2024. France will only have 18 teams in Ligue 1, with four clubs going down in 21-22 and two going up. There you go.
I'm hearing. I understand. Thanks for that breaking news, Philippe. And thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ewan.
Cheers, guys.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.